Now, my friends on TalkSport and Shot Radio, despite the seemingly ceaseless parade of Premier League triumphs and an all-concrete cavalcade of cup wins, Pep Guardiola's Man City adventure really only climaxed last season when they finally clinched and claimed the Champions League title. And in club football terms, it is, of course, the ultimate prize, the holy grail of the beautiful game. At least that's how it's regarded now. But the mightiest eight of oaks spring from little acorns. In this case, an almost entirely forgotten football competition kind of spawned the Champions League. It was the first ever international tournament played between countries which, apart, I think I'm right in saying, from Italy, have pretty much disappeared from the world map. It was a competition without penalties, and never mind the high precedent playing out from the back of these days, this was an era when Danubian-style football was all the rage. To tell us more, let's say good morning to Joe Arif, author of this brilliant book called The Forgotten Cup, History of the Mitropa Cup, Mother of the Champions League, 1927 to 1940, also one of the many people contributing to the rather fine Goal podcast. He'll tell us more about that in just a moment, called gameofgoals.it. But first of all, let's say good morning to Joe Arif. Joe, congratulations on the book. It's a fantastic read. What was the situation like then, was going around in football? Because it started, really, thoughts of this started before the First World War, I think, didn't they, the Mitropa?
Yes, what happened was that in the 1920s, the world was changing a lot because it came from the First World War I, and countries were trying, like, you know, to restart their relationships because there were lots of tensions in Europe, and football played a major role in making these relationships improve and get better. And this was when, like, you know, the World Cup was born in 1930, with the first edition played in Uruguay. And a bit before that, in 1927, a club competition, international club competition, was founded as well. And that was the Mitropa Cup, which was the first experiment, like, you know, to see a major tournament for clubs around Europe. What's a bit surprising is that the teams back then weren't, like, you know, the ones we know together today. They weren't Real Madrid, Barcelona, or any English team, but there were teams from Hungary, Austria, Czechoslovakia, all teams that now don't play, like, in a major role in football.
In fact, we've also got some great characters emerging. And one man who early on features very largely in these stories is the man who referees an early match between countries called Hugo Meissel. He was a former footballer. And he's like, you describe him as the major driving force and visionary within football at that time. What did he contribute? How important was he, Joe, this Hugo Meissel?
He was extremely important. He was, like, you know, one of the main of Europe's main figureheads of that time, because he was the character who founded the Mitropa Cup and the International Cup. And before that, in the early years of the 20th century, he organized football matches and competition between English teams who came to the continent to challenge European teams, like Austrian teams, Hungarian teams. So he was a person who firmly believed in soccer, firmly believed football was going to improve and was going to become a business, something that wasn't something that we should take for granted 100 years ago. He was also a player, not very successful, but he was a midfielder, and he was also a coach, a big coach. And he coached the Austrian team in the 30s when they played the World Cup in Italy. And he was known for his style, which was regarded as quite innovative. And the way they played, like, you know, the false nine or just in love, was perhaps the main innovation, like, you know, he brought to football.
Right. And again, I think Mitropa, we could translate as Middle European Cup, because there were a lot of these Central European nations. But a number of English or British people feature very largely, including somebody who'd been a player, I think, for Arsenal. I think when it was Woolwich Arsenal, the first player to reach 250 appearances for the Arsenal. Tell us a bit about John Dick, who I think went on to form Steel Sparta, I think they're translated as, aren't they? A fascinating sounding man.
Yeah, Steel Sparta was the first team who won the Mitropa. Well, in 1927... They weren't as strong as they used to be, like, you know, in the previous years. They were known to be, like, in a very strong team in the early 20s and even before. They also traveled to South America and all over Europe. And they were seen as, unbeatable. Like, you know, they were seen, like, you know, as a team you couldn't beat. They had this player, very iconic, called Kada, Pesce Kada. He was a midfielder, the captain, who was, like, you know, perhaps Czechoslovakia's main player of that time. And, yeah, they won the Mitropa Cup in 1927 in a final against Rapid Vienna. And in that final, in the in the second leg of that final, because the final were like played in two legs, you could see like, you know, how the situation was heated in Europe. There were many clashes between supporters, and Carla was hit by a stone from the from the stand.
And also, of course, events, world events, impact on football, auto football. And the Great War in particular seems to see a number of very important players captured and imprisoned. And then some of them are kind of, through a bit of, I don't know whether it's bribery or influence, are kind of allowed out from the prison of war camps to help set up or to help kind of move forward international football. Can you tell us about some of those players, please? I mean, I think there's James, somebody called, known as Jimmy, was it Hogan or Hopper? And also a man called Steve Bloom, I think. Stephen Bloom's involved in that.
Exactly. Yeah. It was quite curious because some players, coming from the from Britain, they had come to the continent like to become coaches and to teach Europeans how to play the game.
Yeah.
But then they feel trapped. They found themselves trapped in Europe during the war, and they couldn't escape because they became prisoners. Steve Loomer was one of them. John Cameron was another one. Stixley was another one. They were sent to a camp, Uchleben in Germany, and there, like you know, they organized football matches and tournaments. There is a beautiful book about it, actually. and they're like an examples of players who wander like in to find luck, and then they found something different. Even though after that, Jimmy Hogan had a great career in Europe, and other players like you know those who were born in Italy or Austria sometimes became orphans. They became orphans because their fathers died at the front, and then years after they played against each other on the pitch. Your supporters, like, you know, had lost sometimes their fathers. So that's another reason why, like, you know, it was quite hard, like, you know, to make a relationship better because someone was, like, you know, very vengeful against, like, you know, other supporters.
Sure. And in fact, I learned from this book, folks, I mean, it's amazing, but packed with detail. It covers that period between the wars, but also the aftermath of the war. And I'd never heard of that Hungarian chant. Is it Hudge, Hudge, Hurray? They used to chant for, generally. But it was banned by the Russians because Hudge has a rather unfortunate, it's a slang term for the male member, I think, isn't it? So they had to stop them. They stopped them chanting on the terraces in Magyarland.
You mean, sorry, went to Hungary? I didn't understand.
No, I was saying that one of their chants was, in fact, banned then by the Soviets after the Second World War, partly because it sounded very rude indeed to Russian ears when they turned up. And, of course, I mean, the terrible thing about this saga is when the Second World War turns up, many players, great players, don't make it through. Coaches don't make it through. Some of them, and we learned, dying, being killed only 5 years, for 5 days, sorry, for example, before the liberation of Hungary, before the Russians roll across. They lose their lives after being tortured, some of them imprisoned, mainly because they're so associated with the nationalist cause.
Yeah, what happened was that Hungary was hit by dictatorships for around 30 years. In the interwar years, there was like in a black dictatorship by all teams. Which wasn't like you know as harsh as like you know what happened after the Second World War. After that, like you know, they had a second great generation who played the second World Cup final. That was to have the best team that I think like you know Eastern Europe ever had. That of Puskas is a good team, but even in the 30s they had a great team with Sarrazy. Won the Pernambuco finally in 1938 against Italy, they lost. But they had, like, you know, perhaps the best club in Europe, Ferenc Varos, who won the Mitropa twice and played another two or three finals. So, yeah, it was, like, you know, a very strong football movement.
And towards the end of the book, you remind us of the story of that remarkable-sounding man, Bela Gutmann, of course, who's of Jewish heritage, so he's in terrible trouble, terrible danger when the Nazis roll into Budapest and stuff. And and other people, friends of his around him, get betrayed in the end, it sounds like, by this. They confide to a woman who's working as a sex worker and she tells her pimp, and they end up having the most horrendous-sounding end. What happened then after the Second World War, Joe, to make the Mitropa fade into obscurity, to be taken over by UEFA, if you like, and things like the Champions League and the Europa and the old European Cup? Why did the Mitropa kind of fall away, if you like?
Well, in my opinion, everything changed because some countries chose to escape them. In 1938, for instance, Austria became part of Germany. And after that, after the war, a very destructive war, We have had the Holocaust. That was like, you know, one element, because you have to consider that many coaches, many chairmen, and sometimes even players were Jews. And so everything changed, even in terms of some of how some countries disappeared or were like, you know, strongly hit by the repercussions of the war. And there are some nations where football was trading that wanted to have a more important role in football. So like a nation like Austria, who always had a great team, well, became like, you know, sort of big power player in football. They played a good World Cup in 54, but they weren't the same as before. And it's like everything changed, because countries like Spain or France, they started wanting, like, you know, to be part of this business. And also the relationship that countries have, like, you know, during the interwar years, Hungary, Austria, Czechoslovakia, weren't the same anymore. So they couldn't, like, you know, recreate the conditions to play another Mitropa Cup. So that's how Champions League was born. Hungary had a great team, as I said before, but you have to consider that that team was born thanks to a generation that thrived in the 20s.
Yeah, and in fact, we've got the story in this book as well, encapsulates that tension early days between those who wanted the game to be professional and those who wanted it to remain as an amateur. The book's called The Forgotten Cup, History of the Mitropa Cup, Mother of the Champions League, 1927 to 1940. It covers a much bigger period than that. Published by Pitch. It's our sports book of the week here on Talk Sports and Talk Radio's overnight show. And I mentioned in my intro two things. One was gameofgoals.it. But before we get to that and your involvement in that, to Joe, I mentioned also Danubian-style football. How would you... I mean, obviously, it's linked to the Danube, which runs right the way through Germany, Hungary, whatever. What was Danubian football? Why was that a bit revolutionary?
It's kind of style. So a style that came from the Scottish. It was innovative. It wasn't unique. The style came from the Scottish, and it was characterised by short passes. It was an attacking-minded football. Like, you know, they played to score one goal more than the opponent. They didn't think much about defending, and the same could be seen, like, you know, in Hungary in the 50s. Those teams, like, you know, were very, very strong when they could attack. And they produced, like, you know, very entertaining football. In Austria, like, you know, supporters complained when their teams won without showing, like, something entertaining, for instance.
I see. So if they were slogging out like 1-0 the Arsenal, they didn't like it. They preferred that Danubian attacking stuff. I think brought to that part of the world initially by a British chap, I think, wasn't it, from Scotland? Kind of, he chose to give them the Scottish style of football as it was then.
You mean like, you know, the connection with Scotland?
Yes, yeah. I think it was a British chap who kind of took it over there, wasn't it, as a coach?
Yeah, what happened was that, you know, some coaches came from Scotland, some others didn't. But they had, like, you know, they were exposed to Scottish football. And they advocated Scottish football. So when they came to the continent, they tried to, for some reason, like, you know, Scottish style prevailed. Yeah. Well, not everywhere, of course, because if you think about Italy, Vittorio Pozzo loved English football, and he wanted to adapt, like, you know, the Italian national team to the English style. That was the reason why he never played. He almost never played with Nasser as a number nine.
I think they've got, you see in the book, folks, Italy gets criticism at times of being more physical, shall we say, than some of the other countries involved. It's a great read. It's called The Forgotten Cup by Joe Araf, A-R-A-F. And I mentioned very quickly, Joe, tell us about gameofgoals.it, which we can find online, I know.
Well, Game of Goals is a magazine we founded in 2018, and it's about, like, you know, football history. We also deal with the contemporary football, but we specialize in football history. We like to tell little known stories about what happened, like, you know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago. And we like to go in depth. We like, you know, to tell stories from our perspective. And want to tell, we use, like, you know, some sources, like, you know, we translate sources and we tell something that people use today. Tend to forget.
And it's our type of organisation, because it's all about anniversaries and history, as is the book. It's a brilliant read, The Forgotten Cup by Joe Araf, published by Pitch, our Talk Sports and Talk Radio book of the week as far as sports is concerned. And we're live till 5. Cheers, Joe.